The Vietnam War was the first televised war, and there have been numerous documentary films made about it. But I must admit that my understanding of the fall of Saigon, the evacuation of U.S. personnel, and the moral decisions made by soldiers and diplomats on the ground has been rather vague at best. And I suspect that's true for most of us. In Last Days in Vietnam, Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker Rory Kennedy brings us back to the South Vietnamese capital in April 1975. And using archival footage and firsthand accounts from key politicians and military personnel, she tells remarkable stories of that chaotic time. I'm very pleased that it brings Rory Kennedy back to our show, along with retired U.S. Army Captain Stuart Harrington, who was one of the last to leave. The film opens tomorrow at Lincoln Plaza and Sunshine Cinemas. Rory, hello to our hello. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
And Stuart, you hear us?
I hear you very clearly.
Thank you. Even though you're all the way in California. Rory, among the many ironies highlighted in this film, one that struck me was that for a war that was so well documented, we know so very little about what happened in the final weeks and days. Why do you think that's been the case?
You know, I think that in the immediate aftermath of the war, that it was not a moment we were particularly proud of as a country, and I think we wanted to move on pretty quickly and not really look back at the events. And so there really hasn't been an opportunity to reflect back on these final days until really more recently.
Well, there are two very well-known images of our last days in Vietnam. An overcrowded helicopter making a wobbly takeoff from a rooftop, and another chopper being pushed off a ship from the into the South China Seas. Are they deceptive at telling us what was really happening at that time?
You know, I think those are iconic images, and I think they're iconic because they actually capture a moment, and they capture the chaos of really what happened in Saigon in those last 24 hours. So I think they do speak a truth in that manner, but I think, like you and myself and so many other people, that's as far as many know about what happened.
And what got you thinking about coming up with the more complete story?
Well, I've always been fascinated by Vietnam, and, you know, I think it's a seminal event in our nation's history. And growing up, it was kind of in the ether of my household. And having an opportunity now to look at getting out of Vietnam during those final days, I thought was also timely, given that we were also in the midst of getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And so it seemed to echo some of the challenges that we were facing today, and I thought perhaps provide some insight as well.
And while you were working on this film, I suspect you were thinking about what was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, because there are so many parallels.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you see the footage coming out of Iraq, where people are, you know, the Iraqis are desperately trying to get into American helicopters, and it really feels like you're in Saigon 40 years ago.
Also, it's pretty incredible. The reactions in Washington and in the press to these stories and the mixed messages we get about what we should be doing and not doing.
Yeah, I think that it is a confusing time, and one of the lessons I feel like I've learned from making this film and having a deeper appreciation of what exactly happened in Saigon during these final days is that there were very few good options available at that point, which it makes me feel, you know, even more so now that you really have to understand what the exit strategy is when you enter these wars or conflicts or engagements, and before doing so and before committing, because once you get to that place, both where we are in Iraq and where we were in Saigon, I think there are very few good options available.
Stuart, how long had you been in Saigon when all of this happened?
I'd actually been in Saigon since shortly after the ceasefire. Ceasefire was March of 1973. I got there the first week of August. And, of course, during the war, I'd been over there for the better part of 2 years. So I guess I was almost, I was pushing in my fourth year as a veteran of Vietnam.
And you spoke some Vietnamese?
Yes, I'd been to the Army Language School and learned Vietnamese. Actually, I learned it quite well, and that was a big advantage. Was also a disadvantage in the sense that because one could speak the language, you really had a better sense of what was going on than the average American. And at that time, the die was cast. It was clear that it was going to be nothing but a very sad, disappointing ending. And I knew that, and I labored under that burden.
What was your job at the time?
At the time that the country fell, I was a negotiation staff officer with a U.S. delegation that met regularly with the communists to negotiate about the missing and the dead and the repatriation, location and repatriation of remains. So I was really working, flying to Hanoi periodically even, and working on the issue of Article 8B of the Paris Agreement, locating the missing and the dead.
Was there a contingency plan for evacuating non-military personnel from Vietnam in case some emergency arose?
No, that was a think-of-it-always-speak-of-it-never thing during the ceasefire, until things became clearly got into the condition where, you know, something clearly had to be done and the worst was going to happen. But generally speaking, we went about our duties. Everyone thought that there was a chance that the ceasefire, if implemented, would provide the breathing space for some kind of a civilized political solution on the ground. But as the months went by and the North Vietnamese became more and more recovered from their efforts in 71 through 73, it became pretty clear to everybody who followed the situation that this was a bad ending waiting to happen.
Weren't there a number of plans for an orderly evacuation? We wound up using the worst of them.
Actually, only in the spring of 1975, when the die was really cast and the North Vietnamese offensive had started, was there a serious planning consideration and a planning effort underway. And I think what you're referring to is the fact that at the very end they went to what was called Option 4, which was a helicopter lift out of the air base and out of the embassy.
The others involved using large planes, using ships. They all seem to make a lot more sense than this kind of helter-skelter, pile on to the helicopters and hope that you don't have too many people on them.
They did make a lot more sense to use ships, to use fixed-wing transport out of airfields, especially Tan Son Nhut, the major air base. The problem was that all of those plans presupposed that we would control the airfields, control the ports, and control the roads around Saigon. And 16 North Vietnamese divisions careening down Highway 1 in the direction of Saigon obviated that, you know, just basically pulled the rug right out from under that.
My guests are retired U.S. Army Captain Stuart Harrington, who is featured in Rory Kennedy's new film. Rory Kennedy, director and producer of this film called Last Days in Vietnam, which opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza and Sunshine Cinemas. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Rory, when the Paris Peace Accords were signed in January 1973 and they called for a ceasefire, what were the stipulations regarding the breaking of the agreement?
Well, the agreement basically called for a peace, that neither side would invade the other side. There was a secret agreement that Nixon had signed a letter saying that if the North invaded the South, that the United States would come in with full military action. But he didn't get the approval of Congress, so it wasn't really a complete offer. Of course, then Nixon resigned. Ford was then put into office. And the North saw some vulnerability there and felt like there was an opportunity, so they invaded. The United States didn't respond with any military action. They continued their path down to Saigon. They expected it to take 2 years. It took 4 months to get to Saigon, which contributed to the chaos on the ground by the time we got there in the end of April.
Henry Kissinger says in the film that he envisioned a solution similar to what had happened in Korea, where there would be a North Vietnam and a South Vietnam. Korea hasn't worked out all that well, but it's still the two-state solution has still held.
That's right. I think that Kissinger also felt that they were basically had lost the war. And when you sign an agreement, when you've lost a war, the only way that it can really hold on to itself is if both sides are willing to enforce it.
Stuart, how responsible was Ambassador Graham Martin for our being so seemingly caught off guard by the North Vietnamese army as they were heading south for Saigon?
Well, Ambassador Martin was in a tough spot, and we all understand that now, and the years that have intervened give us better hindsight. He certainly was appointed by the president to be the ambassador to the Republic of Vietnam, and he was also, and he made this very clear by his own statements, that he was the representative of the president, number one, and number two, he did not come over to Saigon to be the last ambassador to the Republic of Vietnam. So the ambassador was stubbornly defensive of the South Vietnamese and their right to exist, and very aggressive about the need for the United States, especially the Congress, to fulfill its obligations under the Paris Agreement. And that included one-for-one replacement of military equipment lost during the ceasefire. All that said, when it became clear, and the handwriting was more than just a little bit vivid on the wall, that the situation was going rapidly downhill and was likely to come to an end, he made a judgment call that he didn't want to start talk about evacuations, because that would then trigger the horse sees the water trough type of a situation, and the will to fight and resist and to defend on the part of the South Vietnamese could be infected. So he really was stubbornly insistent that there could be no talk of evacuation. He underestimated the North Vietnamese, whom he said did not have the capability to conquer the South militarily.
Did he overestimate the South Vietnamese forces' ability to hold on to Saigon?
Snatched the words right out of my mouth. He certainly not only underestimated the North Vietnamese, but as we did during the entire war, he overestimated the strengths of the South Vietnamese and played down their weaknesses. And by that time in 1975, after the Yom Kippur War, between the quadrupling of the price of a barrel of crude, which immediately affected the value of the aid dollars that were being parceled out and parsed out very, very, very lightly by the Congress, the situation was just grave. And it was sufficiently grave that serious, serious talk about evacuations and who's going to go and what about our Vietnamese and our commitment to them needed to be on the table, but he would not countenance it.
Hadn't you brought up the idea of leaving Vietnam a month or so earlier than we actually did? Did you bring it up to Ambassador Martin?
No, I didn't have that kind of contact with the ambassador. I was a captain at the time, which was the made me the lowest-ranking officer of the 60 or 70 officers in country under the Paris Agreement, and I didn't have the opportunity to do that. There were people who tried to persuade him and change his mind, but he wouldn't hear of it. And if he thought you were on the wrong side of his assessment that Vietnam is going to survive and we are not going to countenance talk about any other outcome but that, you could find yourself in trouble.
Rory, the feeling I got watching the film was that Graham Martin was both stupidly stubborn and kind of heroic at the same time.
Well, he's a certainly a complex character, and he made some bad decisions early on that I think you know, many feel cost the lives and certainly the quality of life for many Vietnamese to be able to get out of the country.
All the Americans got out?
Yes. Yes, all the Americans got out, but then, of course, you know, once it became clear in those last 24 hours that we had to get out of the country and the evacuation was underway, he was asked to be on the first helicopter out, and he refused to get on that helicopter.
That's the heroic side.
You know, and he made sure that Vietnamese got on those helicopters, and he was committed to the Vietnamese, and he arguably risked his life. There was no knowing when the North was going to come in, if they were going to attack the embassy, and he chose to stay there through the night. And every helicopter that came in, they said, you got to get on this helicopter, and he refused until he got an order from the president that he had to get on a helicopter, and he left at 3:43 in the morning.
There were a lot of Americans still in Vietnam, some military personnel, also non-military. How many altogether do we know?
There was, they estimate between 5,000 and 7,000 So about 6,000 were in the country at that time, 6,000 Americans. But we didn't have any soldiers in the country at that point. It was just, you know, it's personnel who were protecting the embassy, working in the embassy, working in the consulates, and having a presence in the country. But it wasn't on a military level.
Stuart, what was the general atmosphere like in Saigon in April 1975, since you were somebody who could both speak to the Americans and to the Vietnamese? Did you have a different sense of what was going on than others might have?
Yeah, those of us who had good contacts with the Vietnamese, who perhaps spoke the language or were, you know, a lot of guys had Vietnamese wives, really got a sense as the spring of 1975 approached of a great kind of a funk, a deep depression and a fear on the part of the Vietnamese. Remember, the Paris Agreement removed all American military from the country, and we had toe-to-toed it with the North Vietnamese Army for years, and it wound up being a draw. So to the South Vietnamese, when the Americans went home, but the North Vietnamese were permitted to stay in the country, or at least mass right next door, north of the 17th parallel, to the Vietnamese, they saw the calculus here, the equation, as being, you know, extremely, extremely slanted against them. So there was a lot of anxiety, fear, rumors of the United States making deals with China where Vietnam would be given up. That sort of thing began to hit the country. And once a province capital north of Saigon fell in early January and the South Vietnamese military could not retake it, there was a genuine sense that it was, on the part of a lot of Vietnamese, that it was time to head for the exits.
And you too, the sense of inevitability?
Yes, I confess that once Phuc Long fell on the 4th of January, 1975, my 2-year tour was to end in August, and I wrote home and told my parents that I would be home before August, and I quietly and discreetly began shipping what little household goods and stuff that I had in the country, out of the country.
We're talking about a new film called Last Days in Vietnam, which opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza and Sunshine Cinemas. Rory Kennedy directed and produced, and we're also speaking to one of the people who is featured in the film, retired U.S. Army Captain Stuart Harrington, who is one of the last people to leave Saigon. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Rory Kennedy, who has produced and directed a film called Last Days in Vietnam. It opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza and Sunshine Cinemas. And also with us is retired U.S. Army Captain Stuart Harrington, who was one of the last people to leave Saigon. Stuart, for whom did the U.S. evacuation plan apply? Was it mostly about the Americans, or were there certain select South Vietnamese, the ones who had worked with or cooperated with the American forces, who were also on a list to be evacuated?
There was a general sense, and I say from the ambassador on down in this case, that there was certainly a major obligation to Vietnamese, especially what were called high-risk Vietnamese, who had worked so closely with us in various capacities during the war, be it that working for the State Department, the U.S. Information Agency, our Missing in Action negotiations team, or our military headquarters that was there during the treaty. But there was this sense that, of course, all Americans would have to go, and as Rory said, that was a nebulous number in the 5,000 to 7,000 range. But the real issue was, how do you decide which Vietnamese ought to go, and how do you count heads, and what are the criteria that are used for someone to be declared high risk? At one point, the embassy started a project in the spring of 75 to see if they could get a handle on this number. And depending on which parameters they used, they got up to 250,000 people. And at that point in time, military events on the ground overcame the effort. And we had this general sense that everyone who was an American who had Vietnamese counterparts there felt that their counterparts were threatened, that we needed to safe haven their families. And later, if it came to the worst situation, then get out the breadwinners, mostly male husbands.
I would add that 250,000 number were mostly people who had worked with the Americans, but of course they all had families, and the Vietnamese are a very tight-knit family culture, and there was no way those folks were going to leave without their families. So, you know, the projection from there really went up over 1 million people.
And there was a fear, as we said earlier, that by Ambassador Martin, that we might create a panic among the South Vietnamese if we just started evacuating U.S. personnel. One fascinating part of the film is the various code words, phrases, and signs that we use to alert people about the evacuation.
Yes.
You want to talk about some of those, Rory?
Yeah, well, when they officially declared the evacuation, they the code, which they played on the military radio and through the streets of Saigon, was the song White Christmas. Most people are familiar with Bing Crosby's version of that song. So they played that throughout the streets of Saigon. So you know, in the film, see panic in the streets, people racing to get out of the embassy through buses.
Did everybody know that what White Christmas meant, or were certain people clued into it?
Well, it was targeted to the Americans so that they were informed, but there was, you know, there was a number of misinformation and mistakes that were made during the course of this very hectic time, and one of those was that papers that explain this were left throughout the city, so people generally were aware that that song meant that the evacuation was to begin.
Stuart, didn't you face a very real moral dilemma to follow your command and official policy to evacuate only U.S. personnel and their family, or to break rank and risk your entire career by saving South Vietnamese men, women, and children?
All of us faced that dilemma.
What was your mindset at the time, and how did you come to the decision you came to?
Well, most of us were pretty distraught. But in the end, it was a situation that it was so rapidly unfolding and so rapidly getting out of control that you didn't have a lot of time for, you know, moral interrogations of your soul. You just did what was right. And all over Saigon, Americans who worked for the State Department, who were in the Army or the military like me, intelligence agencies, the CIA, the U.S. Information Service, everyone just began in a decentralized but determined way to fall on their sword over, I'm not leaving until my people are taken out. And what they meant by my people was, for example, the librarian, her staff. She would not leave without taking care of her staff. And when they tried to declare her mission non-essential and get her on an airplane, the answer was not only no, but hell no. And she would not leave, and she was, in this sense, you know, not unusual, without something being done to take care of not only her employees, Vietnamese, but their families.
What about you? Were you expected to be among the first to leave, or did you know from the start that you would be one of the last?
No, we knew we were going to be one of the last. In fact, Washington had ordered our small team, the Michigan Action Negotiation Team. There were at that point in time about seven of us left. And we were initially told that even if the city falls, we are to stay there to continue the humanitarian talks with the North Vietnamese over prisoners. So there was no doubt in our mind that we were not only going to be last, but that we might not even leave. And when we went to the embassy on the morning of the 29th of April, we carried food, water, radios, vehicles, and our intention was to lock ourselves up in the embassy until the dust settled and then come out and essentially submit ourselves to the protection of the North Vietnamese Army.
Rory, President Ford asked Congress for $722 million in emergency assistance for the orderly evacuation of Americans and endangered South Vietnamese, and Congress refused to pass his request?
Yes. Congress had...
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. Congress had really been elected on an anti-Vietnam platform. So the people who were leading Congress at that point were not interested in reinvesting in South Vietnam. There were also a number of members of Congress who had gone on a delegation to Vietnam, going around the information they were getting from the White House, Kissinger and others. And, you know, on the ground, they were being told that any military assistance really wasn't going to make a significant impact. So, you know, Congress did refuse to support it. I don't think that Kissinger or Ford was particularly surprised by that. And honestly, I'm not sure how much of a difference that money would have made at that particular juncture.
Were we hearing the same kinds of recriminations we hear today, that the withdrawal of American troops led to this problem, or was it just a concern with how could we get out without having to lose many more lives?
I don't know that people were that focused on what the implications on the ground implications
were. Well, maybe they didn't
have
Barack Obama to blame for the evacuation.
I could add something here. I escorted that congressional delegation, and they met with the communist delegations over the missing in action. They were insulted by what they considered to be the duplicity of the communists. It was an eye-opener for them. One member of the delegation, Bella Abzug, didn't want to talk about the issues on the ground. She wanted to find where are all the political prisoners that Thieu is keeping in his jails. And she coursed about the city demanding to, access to political prisoners. She being at that point in time representative of a pretty far hard over group who just had it with the Vietnamese and were thinking that the only way to solve this military crisis was to essentially deny arms to the one side, the South Vietnamese.
Now, Rory, you tell of the burning of $1 million. Why did we have to burn it? Couldn't that have been put on a helicopter with some of these people?
I think the assessment from the Treasury Department was that it was just too risky to try to move the money, and that it was easier to just burn it in country and I think probably reproduce it again in the United States.
And there was a lot of waste. The helicopters that were bringing people to the ships were all thrown overboard into the sea. Couldn't they have been sent back to get more people?
Well, there were ships like the USS Kirk, which is profiled in the documentary. And just to orient the audience of this show who hasn't seen the film, what was happening was there was a fleet of U.S. ships out in the South China Sea. And then they were helicopters going from that fleet to the embassy, picking up people at the embassy and going back to the fleet. There was a ship called the USS Kirk, which was monitoring the ocean between the fleet and the land to make sure if the North came in and attacked, they would be protected. So what happened was there were a number of South Vietnamese pilots, and even though the South Vietnamese Air Force had fallen apart, there were still pilots and there were still helicopters. So a number of these pilots got into these little Huey helicopters, filled them with their families, and started chasing the U.S. helicopters, which were much larger Chinook helicopters, out to sea, not knowing where they were going or what was going to happen to them or if they had enough gas to survive, but feeling that it was better than staying on land. The USS Kirk was in there, and these Huey helicopters started hovering above the Kirk. They didn't know who it was, and they didn't know if it was enemy or what, but they had the instincts that it was the South Vietnamese, and they called the first helicopter down. They only had a pad for one helicopter, so they really weren't equipped to do this, or trained, for that matter. The first helicopter comes down, helicopter made for four people, 13 people get out of the helicopter. It's these Vietnamese, and then there are other helicopters hovering above, and the crewmen say to the captain, "What should we do? We have no room for these helicopters." And the captain says, "Throw the helicopters overboard.
And one of
let's
the most,
make room for the next one."
One of the most amazing stories and pieces of footage you have involved a South Vietnamese pilot whose Chinook helicopter, a bigger one, is too big to land on the ship. And he just does one of the most amazing feats of piloting anybody probably has ever done.
Well, it's an incredible story. So it was a Chinook helicopter, and the USS Kirk had kind of a large kind of pole in the middle of the ship. And so a Chinook, which is a giant helicopter that fits maybe 40 or 50 people with, it is quite ginormous, would never be able to land on the ship without compromising the ship or itself. So the crew waved the Chinook away, but the pilot was running out of gas, and it turned out that he had his family on board. So he refused to leave. So what he did was he hovered over the USS Kirk, and you have to keep in mind that the Kirk is moving at, 6 or 7 knots through the ocean. He's hovering about 18 feet above the Kirk. They open the door, and he starts throwing his children overboard, and the crewmen on the deck catch each and every one of these kids. It's an incredible moment. An 8-month-old, a 2-year-old, 5-year-old, 7, 9-year-old. They all jump out. They all get caught. And they're safely on deck. But then he's still piloting the helicopter and has nowhere to go. So he goes to the starboard side of the U.S. Kirk. He tilts the helicopter to the right. He jumps off the left side. The helicopter goes down. He goes down into the ocean. There's an explosion and then silence. And then the guy pops up.
Sue, we have very little time left. But when you left, there were still South Vietnamese people left at the U.S. Embassy. Did you have to abandon them?
Yes. There were 420 remaining out of somewhere in the vicinity of 2,500 folks that we inherited when we got to the embassy. And we promised them all around 3 in the morning, don't worry, nobody's going to be left behind as long as I'm here. And this was all in Vietnamese. As long as I'm here, you're safe, and I'm not going to the last helicopter, and that means after you're gone. So don't worry, just stay in line. Throw away your suitcases, and it'll happen. And after these repeated assurances, we were then told by the Marines that there had been a presidential order that no more evacuations would take place unless they were American personnel, and that we, our small team of 6 or 7, was to close it out, presidential order. So at that point, I had to do probably the most distasteful and saddest, worst thing I've ever done, which was to make an excuse to leave these folks that I had to go to the bathroom, sneak into the weeds, and then up to the roof and out at 5:30 in the morning in a Chinook that could have held 44 other people.
We have pretty much run out of time, but do we know what happened to those people, the ones who were left behind? Were they all killed?
Do you want to talk if you've ever run into one of them?
Yes.
10 seconds.
I dreaded for years that I'd ever encounter one of them, and 2 years ago I did. He'd made it out after being left there, after being jailed for escaping, and he thanked me for leaving him behind because he had a girlfriend with him that he said if I would have put him on the helicopter, he would have married her and been miserable.
Last Days in Vietnam opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza and Sunshine Cinemas. Thank you so much, Rory Kennedy and Stuart Harrington.